This is Dottie Pepper, and you're listening to Radio Golf Show.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to this episode of Radio Golf Show, once again in English. We have another very special guest today. I'm personally very excited about it, this hour that we have in front of us, because there's just a plethora of topics we can delve into. Mark, without wasting any time, because this man, we want to spend as much time as we can with, and let's get him introduced, please.
All right, great. Well, it's great to have you on. But before we get started, a few words up front. Lately, I have been criticized for my guest introductions, mostly too long, too vain, too elaborate, needlessly complicated, and so on, whatever. So today I thought I'd try something completely different. Sorry, Ian, that it's on you, but this is how it is. So bear with me. Here we go. Ladies and gentlemen, tonight, we have a special treat for all the golf enthusiasts in the house. We are joined by none other than Ian Carter, a renowned sports journalist and commentator from the BBC, who specializes in golf. He has covered some of the biggest golf events in the world, including the Masters, the US Open, and the Open Championship, and has provided insightful commentary and analysis that has been enjoyed by golf fans everywhere. He is also an author of several books on golf, including biographies of famous golfers like Nick Faldo and Steve Ballesteros. So sit back, relax, and get ready to hear from one of the most knowledgeable and respected voices in the golfing world. Frank, did you notice anything?
That was beautiful.
Right, I'll tell you something.
Who's been criticizing you?
You are the rudest. You're the most. You're a really rude person, Frank, because I'm telling you something now. Okay?
Who's been criticizing you?
Now, listen, and it hopefully didn't sound at all like I sound usually, was written by a artificial intelligence program called
ChatGPT. Oh, God.
And it was written this afternoon. And it's probably the topic that nearly everyone's talking about at the moment. You know, not in the golf world, but in the writing world or in the producing world or in the podcasting world and broadcasting world. So I thought I might give that a go. And somebody said it was beautiful. So thank you very much, Ian. Just to dive into it, does artificial intelligence make you nervous in any way as an author, broadcaster, as someone whose life has been spent making the word tangible using language?
I'm a lot more reassured, Mark. Thank you so much for having me on after that introduction, because there were a lot of inaccuracies in there. I think an awful lot of people would take issue with the notion that my columns are insightful, judging by many of the comments that go on them on the BBC website. But more to the point, I haven't written any biographies of Nick Faldo or Seve Ballesteros. So the artificial intelligence is not quite on the mark. I have on Colin Montgomery, and I've done other books as well. But that's fascinating, isn't it? It's made that leap of faith.
Well, it took the program. It took the program about 3 seconds to spit it out. Right. So, and I've got a 16-year-old next door, and they use it. You know, they use this program for writing texts and exams and everything. So loads of copy and pasting going on. I knew that you didn't write about Faldo. I know the Monty book. I know the book about the Open, very insightful book, actually. But I thought, you know, just to kick off this meeting tonight, talking about artificial intelligence, because it is definitely going to change what we're doing.
Yeah, definitely. And I must admit, you know, I saw a little bit of stuff on social media about it last week. And I did wonder how it would impact on you know, our, our roles really as broadcasters and as writers. And I genuinely don't know what the answer is. My instinct is, I think I've reached a stage in life where I'm going to be a very reluctant adopter of it. I still, whenever I'm writing something, I know this isn't quite artificial intelligence, but it's a similar thing. Whenever I'm writing something big, and I did it today, I've written an interview with that I did with Tyrrell Hatton, and I transcribed every word. Now I know that I could have just put it on, you know, Otter or whatever, yeah, and just have it done that way. But actually, and I've done it through all my book writing projects. I've transcribed every word because I think you have to. It's part of the job, and it helps inform you. Listening back to the conversation really gives you a feel for it, and ultimately, what we do, and this is my big fear as far as artificial intelligence is concerned, what we do is human communication, and we're human to human, and certainly as a broadcaster, I'm just talking to one person, and it might be lots of one people, hopefully it is, but it's, and I'm doing the same when I'm writing, you know, it's a one-on-one that is a human connection, and long may it remain so, I think is ultimately my feeling on this. You know, and I'm a skeptic now that you've put me out. Now I've articulated my thoughts for the very first time.
Well, that's great. Thanks. We can get back to golf if you want to. But I thought, just because I haven't been experimenting with that program, I just thought it's really interesting. I've been talking to friends who are screenwriters and playwrights, and they're all very, very, well, they're not nervous at all, actually, but they do know that producers are out there who are unwilling to discuss details of scripts with authors, and they'll just have intelligence do it for them. And the programs, you know, at least when it comes to language, it's not that bad. So that was it. Frank, what about?
Yeah, I just...
Loads of other topics.
Yeah, well, I got plenty. But as a side note, I asked this GPT last week to tell me about Radio Golf Show, and I stumped it. It had no idea what I was doing. So I'm with you on that. Well, you know, I mean, there's just so many topics, and because you have access to so many players and everybody involved with the game of golf, from Tampon Gate to the new balls and everything. But why don't we start here? And how did you yourself get interested in sport? I mean, where did you grow up, and how did that, or what did that teach you about broadcasting?
Well, I grew up in a city called Leicester in the English Midlands, which I contend is the greatest sporting city in the world. Many of my friends from elsewhere would beg to differ, but we have the most successful rugby union team in our country. We have a football team that created the greatest ever sporting fairy tale when at odds of 5,000 to 1 it won the Premier League.
It sure did.
We have a cricket that has won all of the big trophies in that particular sport, in, you know, county cricket. We've produced great stars like Gary Lineker. David Gower was a very eminent cricketer who started his career at Leicestershire. I could go on with a huge list, and in fact, I was thinking about this the other day. The only thing we're really missing is a great golfer. But having said that, we've had the world snooker champion. We can go through our whole list, and I defy any other city to produce such a range of sporting talent. And so growing up in that city, it was very, very natural to be interested in sport. And I was from a pretty sporty family, not particularly adept at sport, but always very interested in it. So it was always the main topic of conversation kind of growing up. And my dad played golf, and I played golf with him. sports from a very young age. And, you know, and that was in the 1970s. And at school, that was a massive point of difference between me and pretty much everyone else at school. No one else played golf apart from my best mate. And we were best mates because we played golf. So that sort of fostered my interest in the sport of golf in particular, but also I had a massive interest in broadcasting, got myself into broadcasting, studied to be a journalist as well. And so it all kind of came together. And 20 years ago, I was the BBC's tennis correspondent at the time, but the then golf correspondent decided to retire. They knew my interest and passion for the sport, and it was a perfect move for me. So hence I've been the golf correspondent for the BBC for the last 2 decades.
Do you remember your first gig on the radio?
My first gig on the radio, gosh, that was in 1984. And I had walked in a couple of weeks earlier to my local radio station and said, do you have any part-time jobs? And I was faltering in studying to be an accountant at the time. And they said, we have a youth program. Come and see that play out. And that was my first time in a radio studio. I knew from that moment that was the area I wanted to work in. And within a couple of weeks, I'd noticed that the one thing that the youth program didn't have, it was very big on music and culture, but it didn't have any sport. So I suggested I did a weekly sports spot for that. And yeah, that was my first broadcast.
84. Wow. You just said, and it's, I found it incredible that you started off this way when you said you think as if you're talking to one person when you're on the radio, and you know, getting ready for our talk with you, thinking about the difference between TV, sports on TV, and sports on radio. I know that in Germany, talk radio or sports on the radio is almost non-existent, other than the football shows where they break into a song to tell you who scored a goal. But being a big fan of talk radio and sports talk radio in the States, WFAN and WLIW, and who actually had golf on TV. How would you describe the difference between sports on TV and sports on radio? Is it a matter of involvement, of talking to one person? Can you verbalize that?
I've done a little bit of TV and TV commentary, and I apply the same principle there, that it's you are just really talking to one person. It's only one set of ears that's ever listening to you, unless we're in this kind of scenario where obviously I feel like I'm talking to both of you, and the listener's almost kind of eavesdropping on our conversation. But if when you're doing television, I think the big thing for me is to make sure that you're not duplicating what the viewer can already see. And that's where the great Peter Alliss was so magnificent in golf, because he would complement the pictures. He would add to those pictures. And I found it, I must admit, quite difficult to do it just in the very limited bits that I did, which were essentially during the pandemic, and we were all stuck in studios to cover the golf rather than being on the ground. Because when I'm doing radio commentary, I'm telling people what I can see. That's my primary objective. And then I'll have an expert summarizer next to me who will then be able to put what I've described into proper context from a golfing perspective. And in TV, it's different. You're having to say a bit more than just what you can see. And I enjoyed that challenge, I must admit. But it is a very different skill.
Right.
And I was working with Andrew Cotter, who's one of our finest sports broadcasters, and Ken Brown, who's long since developed into a great golf commentator after a great playing career. And I watched them very closely at work when we were doing those commentaries. It was on the it was on the November Masters, and it was on the Wentworth BMW PGA that Tyrrell Hatton won, that I worked on those events. And I learned a heck of a lot there. But my first love is the radio. And I genuinely believe that the pictures are better on the radio, because our job is to get into the imagination of our listener who's doing something else, driving a car, mowing the lawn, doing the ironing, whatever it might be. And they've got us on as means to find out what's going on in whatever sport we're covering.
Right.
And if you tap into the imagination, you can make the memories of what happened there. If it's a big, you know, if it's Medina and Europe have just won the Ryder Cup, Martin Keimer's hold the winning putt, and you've described that moment, I think that someone who was listening to that on the radio would have a more vivid memory of that than someone who's watching it on the TV. I might be wrong. I think I am biased, but that's how I that's my feeling, and radio will always be my first broadcasting love.
I agree with you. Is it just me, or is it the truly greats? And you mentioned Peter Allis, or Howard Cosell, or Johnny Miller, you know, who are flawless and sensational. Are they so sensational because they're bordering on the annoying a little bit?
Bordering on the annoying. I don't think that's what makes them sensational, but I think that's what gives them an added dimension.
Okay.
So there would be times, not very many, but there would be times when I'd think, Peter doesn't seem quite so enamored that Nick Faldo's won and everyone else is celebrating, or something like that, potentially.
Right.
But I think much more is just that genius of complementing the pictures, whether it's being funny about a scene or just offering that insight that is articulated efficiently with the right words, precisely the right words. And that's what Peter could do all the time. Yeah. And Johnny Miller was unafraid of telling it to you straight. And if a guy was choking, he'd tell you a guy was choking. And that would stand out amongst other broadcasters who would be afraid potentially of upsetting the players. I think that there's, if I've got one criticism of golf broadcasting, is that a lot of it is done by former players who are fearful of upsetting the current locker room. And I think that once you have made that transition from the locker room to the commentary booth, that's where your loyalties lie, and your first responsibility is to the viewer or the listener, and it's not to your mates back in the locker room. And if that means that you've got to upset that mate or former colleague, then that's what you have to do, because you're being paid to service the viewer or the listener.
Right.
That was around. I can't remember what the question was now, guys.
It's a terrible question.
No, that's a great question. But there's also this feeling probably of not wanting to be wrong. And you can be wrong. You know, you can really misjudge a situation. You can really say, okay, he's choking, he's going to choke. And then he'll pull himself back again and be in contention after two or three more holes. I think that's a major factor too. I thoroughly miss Peter Allis. Not the last bits he did, because some of it was really borderline annoying, as Frank would have said.
I love borderline annoying. It's just one of my goals.
We all know that.
We do this. I love that.
I think that Faldo did a great job. It was fantastic how Faldo developed from this guy who would, you know, thank the world from the heart of his bottom to this charming guy who could talk about what happens on the golf course.
And very insightfully as well, that, you know, I think he developed into, and he remains a fantastic broadcaster and a great talker. And he was someone in my very early days, I can remember interviewing him. And that was back in the days when you'd be editing on a quarter inch tape and using a razor blade and sticking plaster to put it back together. And Faldo was an absolute nightmare to edit because he never finished a sentence. You could never join the start of the sentence up, get rid of all the ums and ahs, and maybe bypass a question to get to the next interesting bit. It just wouldn't work because he didn't flow and he couldn't finish a sentence. And if you'd said to me then he would become, you know, one of the lead voices for the sport in the commentary booth in his, you know, sporting dotage, I'd have never believed it. But I think he developed into a really, really good commentator.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I'll keep going.
Yeah, come on, keep going. I usually spend a lot of time talking. Yeah. I've got loads of questions coming up. So keep talking.
No, seriously. I was, you know, surprised Faldo because he had that stone cold image. And I remember watching him at Pebble Beach at the I don't know if it was still the Crosby or whatever, you know. And it was a rain delay, and he dressed up as a caddy with a wig and a hat, and you know, he was like walking around as a caddy. And that was the first time I understood him as a human being, really, because he always was that machine. Ian, you've covered the world. You know, there's pictures of you driving down Magnolia Lane, I believe, with your colleagues, or at least it looks like it, on the way to Augusta. Of all the places you've been and you've covered, which was the coolest place, and what did you cover there?
Oh gosh, that's a good question. I would say I could almost argue that my golf reporting career as golf correspondent has been downhill from day five, because the first 4 days of competition I covered were the Heineken Classic at Royal Melbourne. Okay. And as I said before, I was tennis correspondent prior to this role. So I went out in 2003 to the Australian Open in Melbourne to kind of help hand over to my successor in tennis. And then by happy coincidence, the following week was the Heineken Classic, and the following week was a Davis Cup tie that we would be commentating on as well between Great Britain and Australia. So hence a glorious 4 week trip down under, in which the golf tournament that I covered, and the first I covered as the BBC's golf correspondent, was at Royal Melbourne. And I've yet to see a cooler golfing place. Mm-hmm. So, everything about it, you know, the way the bunkers are cut right onto the edge of the green, the layout of the course, the strategy required, the beauty of the place, just so cool, fantastic pies in the press center. You know, I remember all of that, and I've been to countless golf tournaments since then. Mm-hmm. And of course, it was very, very fresh. And I remember also going in for the first day of press conferences, and lo and behold, Greg Norman was the first person in. And I sat there and listened to him hold court for probably half an hour, 45 minutes, in which he talked about rolling back the golf ball, the need to bring it back. And I was just fascinated. I just thought, having had 5 years of tennis press conferences, I listened to Greg and the way that he spoke, how interesting he was. I thought, my God, this is going to be amazing. This job is just going to be so good. If everyone speaks like this, it's, you know, it's just going to be stunning. And of course, it's not always that way. But I think that, you know, in golf, we're blessed with some great articulate figures. I'm really going off topic here now. But that is the answer to the question. Yeah. That is the answer to the question. It's Royal Melbourne.
Got something quite linked to that question. Royal Melbourne's fantastic. Fantastic. It's one of the golf porn centerfolds of my life, you know. But something else. We've had some commentators from German television here on the show, and we were talking about how important it is, or how not important it is, to be there whilst doing the job. So how important is it for you to be there? Or could you imagine doing your job sitting in a cubicle with the world feed and just commenting on the world feed?
How I think it's very important
to be there, to breathe the air, to smell the flowers and to walk the course.
I think it's very important. I think you from my perspective, yeah, I've just come back from Sawgrass, where I commentated on the Players' Championship with two other broadcasters who were back here in the UK. But I was lucky enough to be out there. And ultimately, when we're doing the broadcasting, we're in those circumstances, we're doing it off the TV. So, yes, the question, why the expense of sending me over there? Well, in the course of that week, I spoke to several, countless players, caddies, Jay Monahan from the PGA Tour. I'd spoke to Annika Sorenstam. I spoke to Mark O'Meara. You know, different circumstances brought me in contact with all of these people, and all of these people have different points of view. And they inform you and they let you know what the agenda is. And I think take the level of the golfing conversation that you're going to have to a much higher level.
Yeah.
And notwithstanding that, you know, I saw the storm clouds on the TV start bubbling up on the final day. And I went out of the media center and had a look and got a feel for, is it stormy? Is it going to rain soon? What does it feel like? And I could tell the listeners. And I do think that one of the great things about what we do is to take that listener to where we are. And if you're not there, it's much harder to do that.
Absolutely. But
when we commentate at Augusta at the Masters, we're bringing spring, warm sunshine, glorious surrounds to everybody who is in Northern Europe, still shivering a bit and just pining for those days that are just around the corner. And everybody says, you know, the Masters is the moment that winter ends and we can crack on with the rest of the year. And if we're not there, it's much harder for us to be able to bring people there. So unfortunately at the Masters, we get out onto the golf course as well, but much of my work will be commentating off the television even there. But yeah, I just think it's vital to be there.
Another chance for Rory for the Korea Grand Slam.
Yeah, absolutely. We'll no doubt be talking about that. But equally, you know, he's got to muscle in on this kind of duopoly that is developing between Scottie Scheffler and Jon Rahm this year. I can't think of a more fascinating time to build up to the first major of the year, because, you know, everything that's going on, Liv, I'm sure we'll get onto that. It's the first time that we'll have Cam Smith, DJ, coming up against the cream of the PGA Tour. So, and that narrative that is there, Rory started the year as world number one. He's already won this year in Dubai. Everything that he is doing now is to make sure that he is ready for Augusta. He was up there at the start of last week, after missing the cut at Sawgrass, I understand, playing, you know, a couple of rounds with his dad, familiarizing himself with the place. How's he going to approach it? Is he going to approach it as this massive thing, the Masters, or is he going to take the it's just another golf tournament approach? And I've just got to remain patient and all of that. We've heard every different approach from him down the years. But the one thing is that he left last year with a smile on his face, and he's never done that before, holding out that bunker shot on 18.
Right.
For a 64 final round, runner-up finish. Of course, he wanted to win, but that was the next best thing that he could do. And he said it's the first time he's left there with a smile on his face. So will that smile remain for four crucial days next month? We wait to see. There's a heck of a lot of excitement about it amongst UK and Ireland audiences.
And a guy who owns it, nobody owns Augusta, but Jordan Spieth's been playing well really well. So I'm really excited about it. We've had two guys on the show who are going to be at the Champions Dinner. We've had Bernard and Ben Crenshaw on. So we might be talked about.
We might, but I suspect there'll be more pressing matters.
Maybe, but there's always hope. Yeah, there you go. So many things. Can I go one more, Mark?
Yeah, of course. Of course.
Just one more, because there's, again, so many topics, and live and the ball and all those things we'll get to later.
We'll I want to ask this question. Or in part two.
I want to ask this question. You've been doing this now for almost 20 years, the golf, right?
Yeah.
And I want to ask what changes you've seen in Tiger over the years. Now he's the guy, you know, who has friends on tour. He's hanging out with JT and Ricky Fowler and things like this. He has relations with the fans, which he's
friendly.
Yeah. Which at the beginning, he was totally inaccessible. Right. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about that a little bit?
Yeah. I mean, he's a lot more chilled now. And he knows he's lucky to have two legs. He's lucky to be alive in many respects. He's come through so many character forming and character changing experiences in his life, the extreme highs and some very, very desperate lows as well. And, you know, you think of that graph of his life over the last two decades and more, it's just extraordinary. I don't think he is that much more accessible now. I think he's accessible to his friends, but he's long since been the most powerful voice in the game.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he's gone into business partnership now with Rory McIlroy for this Monday night stuff that is going to be happening. I think he's much happier to be seen smiling and chilled. I think that's the biggest difference I've seen in him. You know, there was up to 2009, it was stony face. Everything was deadly serious. He gave nothing. He gave absolutely nothing. He would do his press conferences, but that would be it. He would do his post-round interview with the host broadcaster, but you had the best, greatest sportsman in the world, arguably, at that time, and you were so often left as a journalist feeding on scraps.
Mm-hmm.
Now, then it obviously all changed with the downfall, the extramarital affairs and everything becoming public in 2009. And then he had to reinvent himself. And when he came back to the Masters in 2010, he was he suddenly started calling reporters by their name. You know, yes, Doug. Yes, Bob. And all of this. And it was a very contrite character who admitted his flaws, and this was someone who never admitted a single flaw. And then it kind of sort of moseyed along like that, but then we got into substantial periods of injury or illness or whatever that interrupted the flow constantly with him. And now, as I say, after the car crash, I think, you know, he's there's a big element of him that he's glad to be able to swing a golf club and not more, and be able to play with his son, Charlie, and the proud parent and all of that kind of thing. But the one thing that has remained an absolute constant throughout it all is that when he turns up at a tournament, whether he believes it or not, when he turns up at a tournament, he will tell you that he is there to win it. And he will do exactly that at Augusta next month. He will say, "I'm here to. I think I can get the job done around here, whatever the circumstances." He's always said it.
Can I tap into that before we move on to the quick nine? Because I'll just pull one question out of the quick nine but it fits here wonderfully. And that is because I'd really like to know, in your opinion, Tiger Woods, what's the greatest championship he ever played? Because there's two major tournaments that I thought that were absolutely brilliant. It was the in Torrey Pines in 2008, I believe. I just rewatched some of the footage this afternoon where he was playing on a broken leg, more or less, and he pushed Rocco into the playoff, and then he pushed the playoff one step into sudden death more. And then there's this other this is this ultimate comeback 2019. Where he sort of just came back from nowhere, and you're going, because everyone was going like, well, he's dead. He's dead. He's not going to come back, you know. And then all of a sudden he's back, you know. So there's this bloke who can break his leg and play golf at a level that nobody could even, you know, conceive. And then this other guy coming back after the most horrendous stuff has happened to him, and win in Augusta, the place where they once told him that he wasn't welcome anymore because he couldn't keep his, you know, stuff together, because he would, you know, go out and sleep with other people's wives, right? So, what would you say is his greatest achievement? Or maybe that's then maybe there's something else.
There was those two were the ones that came straight to my mind, Mark, I must admit. But I think that you ignore at your peril the way he won his first Masters in 1997, which was stunning. You know, first day he
How
went
many
back
shots was
in
that?
14,
10.
12, 12 shots he won
12,
by, didn't
12
he?
shots.
It's ridiculous.
And his front nine on the first day was 40 blows. He went 40-30 that day. And I mean, mind blowing. Absolutely mind blowing. And has set the agenda. And you know, I've heard it said that he's the most underrated golfer who has ever lived. And I've got a certain sympathy with that argument, because I don't think people have properly appreciated what he has achieved. 82 tour wins in the modern era, reeling off five, six, seven, eight, nine wins a year in his prime, 15 majors, and all the setbacks, some of them very, very self-inflicted, but still having that longevity as well. It's utterly extraordinary. And the one thing I remember writing a piece one day where I noticed that the gap between him and Phil Mickelson, who was then the world number two, was larger numerically than the gap between Mickelson in second place and any other golfer on the planet who had a world ranking. That to me, you know, that's just extraordinary, isn't it?
And it's something, you know, if you see him live, well, you've seen him many times live, but I saw him, I think 2006, the Open in Liverpool. I saw him last year, and I saw him in Carnoustie 2018. The command he has over his audience, you know, his sheer, you know, just the way he just is there, and people will follow him.
His presence, isn't it?
His presence, you know, it's so much more than one could imagine. Frank, are we ready for the
No, I just my Tiger story. I took a piss next to him in a restaurant in New York once, the year Retief Goosen won the Open at Shinnecock, the U.S. Open at Shinnecock, and I found him to be quite charming, in the restroom.
Yeah, the toilet, or
Because at that time it was always Mickelson was the nice guy and Tiger was the asshole. I mean, that was how the public really perceived, especially in New York. Everybody loved Phil in New York.
Oh yeah, but isn't that interesting how much that's changed? You know,
Yeah,
now
I
Phil
mean,
Mickelson
I
is
think it
this.
was already it was always like that. It was just that
Yeah, it's
Mickelson had
just
that
people
image and
seeing.
Tiger
Yeah,
didn't.
I think people
Anyway,
sit behind the facade now. Quick nine. Should we do the
yes.
quick nine before?
Nuevo Rasante, what's quick in Spanish?
Nuevo rasante. Okay. What's the most valuable golf tip you have ever been given?
Enjoy yourself and enjoy good shots.
Excellent. You're
Mark.
going to die. We all will. Who would you like to play your last round with?
My wife and my son. I think golf's the golf is the ultimate family sport, and we should make more of it.
Do you get to play with each other a lot?
We've booked a tea time for Sunday. Yeah. First How's time for a few weeks. But
how's your game these days?
My game stinks.
There you go.
Has it always stunk?
No, it's been all right. I mean, for a recreational hacker, I've got down to 5.5 was the best my handicap ever got to. It's currently 7.7, but I'm not playing particularly well. I need to do something about it.
What would you be if you hadn't decided
with my family?
Sorry. What would you be if you hadn't decided to become a broadcaster?
Probably sales or something like that. I don't know.
Car salesperson or something like that.
Maybe.
You must something buy like, this.
I'd have tried to find something that kept me on the move and traveling.
Right. Okay. Well, you're still traveling around. What are you currently reading?
I'm currently reading the latest Michael Connelly, Harry Bosch novel. And I've read it straight after the latest Rebus, and it's not in the same league.
Right. How's the swing at the moment? We've already answered that one. Against all odds, this is the question you will be answering. You have won the club championship. Breathe it. You have won the club championship. You and your mates decide to celebrate at a karaoke club.
Mm-hmm.
What's the first song you'll sing, and what's the song you'll sing when you're totally pissed and need to end it?
I would sing Glen Campbell, Rhinestone Cowboy.
Brilliant.
We're getting into these things now. Rhinestone Cowboy, it's fantastic.
I love that song.
I do. Yeah, that's great. And what
is that? I did sing it in karaoke on a stag do in Portugal last December.
Okay. Where was that in Portugal?
Villamora.
Oh, nice.
Fortunately, in the first week of December in Villamora, there's nobody.
There's no English people. Rhinestone Cowboy would be the first song and the last song of the evening.
Oh, I don't know. You've stumped me. Well, I'd probably just have to do Rhinestone Cowboy again.
There you go.
Okay, we'll put it on the list twice.
Can't wait to listen to that tonight.
We have a Spotify playlist with all the karaoke songs our guests have answered to this list. Oh, we'll send you a link. Do you sometimes dream of golf? And if yes, how are they, these dreams? And would you care to share with us?
I don't tend to dream of golf. My dreams are of cricket, and I have enjoyable hitting cricket shots. As much as I love golf, there is nothing better than scoring runs at cricket, and they come. There's a real rarity factor to it. But I went 25 years without playing cricket, and then when my son got into it, I started playing again. So sometimes, you know, if I've got a weekend off, I will max it out and I'll play golf first thing in the morning, and then go straight off and play 8 hours of cricket afterwards. And days don't get much better than that.
Man's quite gifted, Frank, because he's already answered the next question. Given the choice, would you rather spend the afternoon playing golf or playing cricket?
Wow.
Well, I be a very even contest, but now I've started playing paddle. You know about paddle, the tennis game?
Yeah, the Swedes play that.
Is that
Paddleton? Yeah.
Do you know the film Paddleton? Where these two blokes play. Is that just against the wall?
No, it's like in a cage, no? Like almost in a cage.
Like, yeah, it's in a cage. It's like a hybrid of tennis, squat, and squash, but it's outdoors, and it's brilliant. And I'm obsessed with that now. So it's a three-way choice now.
Wow.
And I don't know the answer.
Okay, good. Well, you don't have to.
Rubbish of all of them as well.
What's the most horrendous thing that's ever happened to you on a golf course?
The under 35s championship at my first golf course, I entered 36 holes, was looking forward to it all week, and stood on the first tee and put three balls out of bounds.
Three.
I can relate.
I've got a whole day left. It was, 36 holes. So very first hole, three balls out of bounds.
One, two, three, four, five, six, seven, eight, nine, mm-hmm. 10. 10 on the first hole. Lovely.
I think it might have been 12, to be fair.
There you go. Very, very, very quick answers, please. Music on the range.
Don't mind.
Match play or stroke play?
Match play.
Walk or ride?
Walk.
Do you warm up or not?
Less and less these days, and my form is paying the price.
What's a gimme?
It's 2 feet and in.
Do you know what a mulligan is, and do you give and take them?
I know what it is, and no.
Parkland or Links? No mulligans. Parkland or Links?
Links, every day of the week.
Driver or putter?
Driver.
For our German, American, Norwegian, Swedish listeners, and we have listeners in 50 countries, I have been informed.
We do.
Can you sum up the game of cricket in two or three simple sentences?
Probably not. basically you throw the ball with a straight arm to try and knock down three poles that stand up next to each other, and the person at the other end has a bat, and they have to hit the ball like in rounders or baseball and avoid those stumps being knocked. And by hitting that, they can then run, and they can and they create runs, and they have to avoid being caught. So if they hit it in the air and it's caught, then they're out and they get replaced. There are 11 players aside, and the team that gets the most runs wins.
I think even I understood that.
What I don't understand about cricket is when they declare, like we've had enough. You can't beat that. Is that what they're doing?
Well, that's because there's a time limit.
There is a time limit. Oh.
Yeah. So the limit could be 1 day, 3 days, 4 days, or 5 days in Test cricket. But you've got to be able to, if you think you've amassed enough runs, you've then got to give yourself time to bowl the other team out. Because if they're not all out, if not all 10 players are out, 11 players are out, or 10 of the 11 players. Oh, now we're complicated. But basically, you just need to. So that's why you would declare. That's why I would say, right, we're going to stop now, and we're going to. And so then the roles reverse, and then you get and try and bowl the opposition out.
A whole dimension I wasn't aware of.
Yeah, and here was me thinking it was simple after he said these first three sentences about the game.
Well, you need two batsmen
come
at the
up
same
with
time.
Declaring stuff, and I don't know a thing anymore.
I know that they drink a lot of booze during these things.
Pins and tea. All right, okay. And that would have been it. I've got. Let's go on to the next topic, if you don't mind. I think because it's in the room. What's length? I think Martin Slumbers said that, I think I read that at the BBC, probably was even you, that he believes that golf has crossed a Rubicon when it comes to length, and stuff has to be done. And so the RNG and the USGA are proposing a
a length reduced ball of some sorts. Is that about time? Is it going to happen? Will there be the ball rollback? Because it's a funny decision, isn't it? Now, just open up the question one more in one dimension. Because, you know, the game's looking good at the moment. You know, numbers are growing, participation in amateurs going up. We've got this new Carnival League, LIV Golf. That's a bit of a disruption, but prize money is up. We've got tremendous young professionals. We've got a great professional game. And now they decide in all this disruption, let's do something about the ball. Is that wise? And what do you make?
I think what's really interesting on this is the apparent departure from one of the central tenets of golf, which has always been that whatever level you play, you're playing the same game. Mm-hmm. So we play with the same equipment as the pros, the same balls, and we're playing exactly the same game. Now, in reality, I don't think that's quite the case. And I think the specs of the pro game, the way that wedges are ground and stuff like that for the pros is completely different. And I've said it so many times and heard it said so many times, they play a totally different game to us amateurs and even elite amateurs. Mm-hmm. But this bifurcation is new, to say that we are going to use a golf ball that will not fly as far as golf balls do at the moment in the elite game, or we're giving the elite game the opportunity to do it that way, while the recreational game remains the same. And all the feedback that the RNA and the USGA got was don't mess with the recreational game. As you say, it's growing, it's doing just fine. But especially the men's game at the very top and at elite levels that trickle down into the amateur game, the golf courses are getting too small for the ability to hit the ball. The ball is being struck too far. If you go back to the 1980s, I think it was 1986, javelin throwers in track and field were propelling that javelin too far, and it was going onto the running track and endangering the 10,000 meters. So rather than widen the field, they said, okay, we'll change the center of balance on a javelin and it won't fly as far, but still the guy that throws it the furthest is going to win. And that's effectively what they're saying should happen in golf now at the very top of the game, that still the longest driver will hit the ball the furthest distance, but that furthest distance, that scale needs to be reined back. And the estimation is that it's going to be 14, 15 yards shorter, mm-hmm, for the top guys. I think, looking at the calculations, I think it's potentially a little bit more than that. I think that's based on a swing speed of 127 miles per hour.
Who swings that?
Well, the average on tour is 114. So... And listen, maths is not my forte by any stretch of the imagination, so I may have got that wrong. But either way, it's dialing it back, and I think that there's plenty of evidence to suggest that that is a very good idea, because otherwise we're going to outgrow the old course at St Andrews, or they are. And I counted six potential par fours on the old course that could be driven at the Open last year.
Well, they were driven, weren't they?
Yeah. I mean, depending on the wind position and that sort of thing. And I think that they, you know, that he said, you know, crossed a Rubicon. I think there's a line drawn in the sand here. And now there's a 6-month period for the game to feed back and all the different constituent parts to say, yay or nay, we like that idea, or offer whatever feedback that they have. And then once that's been processed, then a decision will be made. And this change, if it is approved, will come in 2026.
And you think it will come? I think
I suspect it will. Yes, I think it appears to me that they have taken such great care over a very long time, like the last 6 years, to take into account all the constituent parts of the game and their feelings on this subject, and they have altered how they envisaged doing it. They were considering things like reducing the size of driver heads to make sweet spots smaller, changing the moment of inertia, coefficient of restitution. I mean, all of that has been pored over. And I think that, you know, ultimately golf is the only sport that changes the playing field rather than the equipment when suddenly it's not fit for purpose for whatever reason. I was listening to another podcast today, in which Mike One of the USGA made the point that they use different balls in the NFL, because if Tom Brady was using the one in the junior game or in the amateur game, the pitch would be too long. Would rather be too short. Mm-hmm. His throws would be too long. So, so it's not unprecedented. You know, I gave the javelin example, and golf has enjoyed its points of difference, but I think this is one where I suspect ultimately the consensus will be to go for change. But I think what will be really interesting in this argument, and what could alter my opinion on that very easily, is what Fred Ridley says at Augusta when he does his news conference on the Wednesday of Masters Week, because he'll be asked this question. And if the Masters are in favour of it, then that is a massive step towards it happening.
Well, Eddie Izzard did a brilliant bit on the javelin in his Stoned Olympics thing, where the guy gets hit with the javelin. another story. But the example, I mean, if Major League Baseball players were using aluminum bats, we'd have dead pitchers every week. You know, like they do even in college, they use aluminum bats. So, what do you make of the reaction of some of the players, like JT? I mean, listening to JT with his Titleist hat on, you know, not being for it is really no surprise. But I think one of the guys that's been really outspoken about it is Bryson as well. You know, who wants to be rewarded for going to the gym. I can tell you this. I'm hitting the ball further now than I did at the top of my game 25 years ago, and I haven't been to the gym once. So I don't buy that argument. But what's your reaction to their reaction?
I think it was a bit predictable. I don't think Bryson gets it, because he can still go to the gym and he can still be the longest player. It won't fly that far, but the differential might even help him. So I don't think he's quite understood that point. Just look at Justin Thomas's cap, and that kind of explains where he was coming from. The ball manufacturers don't seem to be in favor. They've got to be won over. The one thing that I really sort of bridle at is when the players say, why are people with 5-15 handicaps making decisions for us pros? And I just think to myself, you are sounding very, very entitled right now.
Yeah, they are.
You know, the fact that you can hit a ball into a hole more efficiently than pretty much anyone else in the planet, does that qualify you to analyze all of the data that is involved in running a game, a sport, and you're 0.1% of that sport? And yet, you know, what difference does it make for the people involved in this decision-making process, what standard of golf they are? Yes, they need to have an appreciation of the game, and certainly if they can play to a standard, that might help. But how arrogant to say that. I I don't like that at all.
No, especially because you're saying that it's only it's only 0.01% of the worldwide players, and if their needs and their game change, you know, all these fantastic courses we still all love. You know, if you're teeing off on the 17th hole at St. Andrews and you're basically standing in the middle of the driving range on the other side of the wall, right?
It's wrong
because
as a professional golfer, how are you qualified to analyze how much more water it will take to cater for extended tees and all the extra expense that comes in with extending a golf course? How are you qualified to cope with dealing with a television executive when you have to say, well, actually, no, rounds are going to average 5.5 hours now because everyone's waiting. To walk. You know, too much walking, too much waiting, too much, you know, all of these factors come in that very clever people have to deal with and analyze and come up with proposals. And frankly, your golf handicap shouldn't have anything to do with that whatsoever, in my opinion, or your ability to be able to do that.
Have we got time for one more topic? Because there's something I still want to... Yeah, we do. Frank, do you want to stick to the ball or can we just move on to our pet topic?
Yeah, but there's plenty of target. I think we're done with the balls.
It's the other one is LIV Tour. You know, there's this... The elephant in the room, LIV. It's in the middle of their second season now. No, the beginning of their second season. Somebody won a load of money on a course. I don't remember where. I don't remember who. I think he won $4 million but nobody seems interested. And still it's there. Still it's disruptive. Yeah. But I know no one who's really interested in LIV Tour. I don't know. Frank, do you know people? Do you discuss LIV Tour with other people than with me?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know anybody. I'm certainly not interested. I just check the scoreboard on a Sunday night to see how badly Mickelson played, especially after what Freddie Couples just said. If you're paying him $200 million to shoot 75, age 50.
How did he fare this weekend?
I don't know. I mean, you know, he's a non-factor.
So what do we make of this, Ian? Because that is something, you know, I'd really value your opinion on this one because it's a bit of it's like a Cinderella show or Holiday on Ice. Somebody called it Holiday on Ice in an interview I read. Or it's like wrestling. But it's still, you know.
I've heard it likened to sort of the Harlem Globetrotters or
something like that.
Yeah. And I can see sympathy for that argument. This is an assembled cast, 48 players, and yes, some really big names in there, and some players who have seen better days undoubtedly in there. And I wonder the most intriguing question when we get to Augusta will be how Cameron Smith, Dustin Johnson, Patrick Reed, these kind of guys fare, because I've been to two LIV events and I didn't feel the same competitive vibe that I feel when I go to any of the tour events and certainly majors. I think you said it earlier in the podcast, you know, you mentioned sort of the carnival atmosphere and 54 holes, shotgun start, guaranteed money, no cut. That's a real challenge to preserve your competitive edge to be one of the very best golfers in the world, I would think. So I think that's one of the big questions that will potentially be answered at the majors this year. How well do the LIV players play? Because like last week, I wrote it down here. So DJ was 13th, Danny Lee won in Tucson. DJ was 13th, Reed 18th, Cam Smith 24th,
and DeChambeau 44th of 48 players, and they're not the 48 best players in the world. So that those kind of levels of performance, with one tournament to go in Orlando the week before the Masters, three competitive rounds, that's all they've got left. Like, all the leading players on the PGA Tour have got guaranteed three rounds at the match play this week, and then could go, you know, and play the PGA Tour the week after if they felt like they needed to sharpen up their competitive edges before they go get to Augusta. So I think the LIV players are, in terms of the majors, looks to me like they're at a bit of a disadvantage.
Do you think there's any chance that they will be they'll be rewarded world rankings? Do you think it's going to happen? Because is this being discussed in certain circles?
Yeah, it will be discussed. I'm sure it will come up on the agenda when the four majors meet to discuss, you know, to have their next OWGR meeting, which is going to be at Augusta. And bear in mind that the DP World Tour and the PGA Tour have recused themselves from the discussion because obviously they're involved in litigation against LIV. And so it wouldn't be right for them to be involved. And I think there's a pressure on the majors to give world ranking points to LIV, because they want to have the strongest fields that they can have. And the big point of difference that they have is that LIV players could still be eligible for those events when, at a time when they're banned from the PGA Tour and potentially banned from the DP World Tour, as we wait for the arbitration hearing result, which could come any time. So I think... I wrote a piece on the BBC Sport website where I said, yeah, give them a world ranking points, but make sure that they're weighted in such a way that it reflects that it's 54 holes, it reflects there are no cuts, and it reflects the strength of the field. Because we had so much rhetoric coming out of the LIV camp towards the end of their beta season, their initial run of eight tournaments, which basically said, you know, is how can you say that Dustin Johnson is not one of the best five golfers in the world? Well, he was outside the top 10 when he went to LIV. He's won one of their events and he's finished third twice. Well, and against those fields. And my reasoning was, well, give us the empirical data.
The stats, right.
That he's one of the top five players in the world. Because at the moment, we can't work it out, because we don't know the absolute strength of the LIV fields. We know that they're playing a form of the game that might be a bit cushier than what the rest of them are playing week in, week out. But I say give them the rankings. It would strengthen LIV's position and perhaps strengthen their hand in trying to recruit players from the PGA Tour. But equally, I think, you know, it's inarguable that you've got some of the world's best players there. So it is a competition of a certain legitimacy, and, you know, take into account all those different factors. Yeah, give them ranking points. But let's actually then see how good these players are. Because I don't think Dustin Johnson's a top 10 player in the world anymore. But I don't know. That's just my opinion.
Well, Bryson doesn't really give the impression he is one, for example, does he? Bryson DeChambeau doesn't really seem like he's, you know, recovered from all this hurting and these accidents he's had. So, right. We have been keeping you for more than an hour.
I have one more thing that I wanted to say about the
literature. Not running away yet.
I don't think so. And Ian, and maybe you can answer this as a fan and as an Englishman, The fact that guys like Westwood and Poulter or Graham McDowell, who obviously you're close to, and Henrik Stenson are throwing away their chance at Ryder Cup captaincies.
Yeah, I just think that's, I think it's really, really sad. Whatever the rights and wrongs of the decision, I think it looks highly unlikely that they will figure in the firmament of the DP World Tour going forward. And I just think it's really sad for all concerned. I think that they as players have given so much to European golf that we should have seen them in that role in an event that means so much to European golf fans. And I fully understand why that opportunity, it looks like it's not going to be there for them going forward. I think that's incredibly sad. And also, thought occurred to me, when they were coming through, they had the experience of playing under Seve Ballesteros as a captain, Colin Montgomery, Jose Maria Olazabal, Thomas Bjorn, some of the great figures of European golf. Now, surely for the benefit of European golf, that the generation that's coming through now should be able to play under the Stensons and the Westwoods and the Poulters and all of that. And that's really sad that that's not going to happen. Having said that, you know, Sergio Garcia being another case in point. Mm-hmm. Having said that, I fully get why that's the case. And I can see all sides to this argument, but overall it's just really very, very sad. And my overall take of the whole LIV arrival is, whatever the rights and wrongs of how they're funded and all of that, and the way that they've come in and the way that they've shaken up the game, they have changed it. And it has become fractured. Mm-hmm. And my big question is men's golf, with everything else that is there to attract people's attention, is men's golf big enough to be split? I'm not sure. Mm-hmm. And that is, you know, it's going to be fascinating to see whether LIV can make a go of it, whether Saudi Arabia will keep funding it, will feel that they're getting a return from it. These are all massive questions going forward. And if they did fold, what would happen then? Would the PGA Tour then welcome these guys back?
It's like Europe welcoming back Great Britain after the Brexit failed.
Right? Yeah, well, don't get... I can't go there.
Sorry, I didn't want to twist it into that.
But how about the animosity between the players?
I'll stick with the goal. But yeah, the animosity with the players. But
between the players, you know, who are not friends anymore, apparently.
Yeah. But I mean, real? You know, they're the most selfish people in the world anyway, aren't they, professional golfers? So they're going to go... when they're on the golf course, they're only interested in one thing, and their ball and where it's gone. And, you know, people will have their differences. But say LIV did fold, does that mean that a talent like Cameron Smith at such an early age is lost to the game forever?
Yeah. Thomas Peters. I mean, there are young guys there that are, you know, I mean.
But, you know, especially Cam Smith.
Yeah.
And we're talking about this amazing sort of tripartite kind of battle that is there between Scheffler, Rahm and McIlroy right now. Well, it should be the big four, you know, and it might be the big four. If Cam Smith comes in and wins,
he might win.
Then we've got the big four, and wow, we've got an amazing calendar ahead. So it's not all doom and gloom, but the whole thing just raises so many questions, so many points of interest, and I've never known a more fascinating time to be doing my job. So
it's a great time to be writing and thinking about golf, isn't it?
Yeah, very much so on all fronts. So yeah, it's an incredible time.
All right, very cool. Let's wrap it up. I mean, this has been Tea Time with Ian Carter, BBC Radio. This is what I love about about your lingua franca. The EA in T is silent. I think that's fantastic.
I've got one more. Can I shove one more?
Because
it's a really personal question. Two reasons I decided to go into podcasting. That was Frank Furster, and it was you and Andrew Cotter with The Cut. Why did you stop producing The Cut? What happened to The Cut? That was such an awesome format. That was so great. You talking about cricket, the interviews, the banter between the both of you. It was the role model for halfway grown up golf podcasts. And I was absolutely devastated. I'm going to say this again, that you stopped doing it. Is there any chance that it'll come back, or are you guys?
We would both love to be podding together. It's a very difficult and competitive world when you're working for the BBC, because there are so many priorities for the corporation and for BBC Sport. And I go back to the point that I made just a moment ago: can golf afford to be split when there are so many competing elements and we all, you know, I think some of us just live on planet golf and don't realize the wider picture. And the wider picture from the BBC's point of view kind of meant that we didn't continue with The Cut, but it's something that we really, really enjoyed massively. You know, maybe one day we'll be able to win an argument and get ourselves back together.
Or maybe Frank and I can invite you both back into a show during the Open Championship.
That would be a scoop. Something like that.
And see if we can get Cotter and Carter together.
Yeah, well, ladies and gentlemen, this has been Radio Golf Show with Mr. Ian Carter. And I usually finish these things with a quote. I really couldn't find one. To be honest, I didn't really look. Not quotes by our guests, but something that fits. But I do like to start reading books at the end. I've said that a few times now. And this baby right here, Monty's Manor. And I started, I usually look for the bibliography. There wasn't one. There is an appendix of all of Monty's Ryder Cup matches that involved him, which is amazing. But in the back of the dust jacket, it says this: Ian Carter has been covering sport for the BBC for over 20 years. Since 2003, he has been the voice of Radio 5 Live's golf coverage. Monty's Manor is his first book. And now here, boys and girls, we have a gentleman. It's his first book, and the foreword is written by Seve Ballesteros, and the afterword by Graham McDowell. I mean, that's something you don't see every day. It's been an absolute pleasure, sir, to have you on the program. And this book, I haven't read the one about the Open. I know you have, Mark, but this book is absolutely fascinating. If you love golf, if you love the Ryder Cup, I'm not even a big fan of Monty, but I love this book. So thank you very much.
Thank you. That's very kind. Thank you very much. And if I could say one thing, I don't think I've ever been as proud as the day when Seve agreed to write the foreword to that book. That was something very, very special. I really appreciate you reminding me of that. That's very kind. Thank you.
Absolutely. Yeah. And again, you know, it's just sensational that, you know, it's your first book and you have these two guys. We'll be following you somehow on internet. I mean, I'm sure BBC Five is somewhere on the internet radios with the Sirius and all this
BBC
stuff.
Sound.
There you go. We encourage you to do the same. Ian, safe travels to Augusta. We'll be doing a show about how to play the back nine at Augusta with hopefully somebody who's played it a few times. So look for that, and we'll see you next week. I'm Frank Forster.
I'm Mark Hogner. To the Linksland.